Always like being part of the service when Julian and Dan lead. I think there's a good tone been set. Thank you very much. Julian, that song about will your grace run out if I let you down, I think we should keep that one in our... In fact, someone should preach on that sometime. It was a profound song. I also want to thank Paul for helping me with a small technical glitch this morning. Didn't have the right plug on my computer to make this work, so... The beauty of technology, I emailed it to him this morning, who then put it on his computer, who then hooked it up here, so we'll all work. And I also have to commend Danny for not panicking when there's no kids in here to do communion and offering. I mean, we're starting a new series today. This is a new season. This is the beginning of, I don't know if you felt that, Daddy was saying that already, you know, September, the beginning of the fiscal year, beginning of the school year. I had my end-of-year softball tournament yesterday in the rain, and my team won 2 games all season and kept that up yesterday. We had a good time, and it was fun. But it's the end of that, and now it's a new season. We're starting again, and so I get to start the next sermon series. Over the summer, we looked at a bunch of songs, songs that we typically sing here, and I very much enjoyed all the weeks that I was here and the interesting things that I learned. But now as we look into the fall, we decided it was time to take a look at one of the books of the Bible. And so we're going to spend the next few weeks on 1 Peter. And if you have a Bible, I would encourage you to turn to 1 Peter. If you don't have one, Grant has kindly volunteered to help pass them out, so you can let him know. There's Bibles at the back. 1 Peter is almost at the end of the Bible. If you get to Revelation, then flip back a few pages and you'll find 1 Peter. This is a letter that was written by Peter. And that's how he starts. He starts out, he says, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ. So it's a letter written by Peter to believers, and we're going to have a look at where they are. But it's a letter. As we know, the Bible, there's a bunch of books in the Bible, and there's different kinds of books. Some are historical, kind of tell the story of what happened. Some are poetic, like the Psalms, that are more emotional expression of things. There are prophetic books that tell us about what things are going to happen in the future. And then in the New Testament, there's a whole series of letters that follow the Gospels that explain how we should live and what it meant for Jesus to come and live on earth. And Peter's letter definitely is one of those. It's a letter that integrates theology. This is what it means to be a Christian, and this is how we should live. And if you look in 1 Peter, you've got your Bible there. It's really quite short, actually. It's, 5 chapters? But if you look even at the titles, if you have subtitles in your Bible, I've got ones that talk about be holy, wives and husbands, submit to rulers and authorities, living for God. Very practical things about how we should behave in the world. But then there's also ones about a living hope, the living stone, a chosen people, which are more about, okay, this is what it means. This is the theology behind what it is that we believe. And Peter integrates those two into this short book. And it's trying to help people understand what it is. This is Peter, who was around when Jesus lived and died and rose again. And now he's writing to a group of people saying, okay, I watched it happen. Now this is what it means, and this is where we should go from here. And if you look at near the very end of 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 12. So at the very end, he says, this is really why I wrote to you. He says, with the help of Silas, who I regard as my faithful brother, I've written to you briefly, encouraging you and testifying that this is the true grace of God. Stand fast in it. So he said, I'm writing to you, or I have written to you, encouraging you and testifying that this is the grace of God. So I want to encourage you in what you believe, and I want to make sure you understand that this is the grace of God. So this is his purpose in writing. So we're going to take a look. Today I'm going to work through the first 9 verses, but over the next few weeks we're going to work through the rest of the book to better understand what it is that Peter is saying and what it is that he's communicating to these people and to us. Now, the last book that we studied through a sermon series was Deuteronomy. And I don't know if you remember the beginning of that session, Don Buckingham explained how many chapters you had to read per day or per week to get through the book of Deuteronomy in the time period. Well, this one's way easier. There's five chapters. You could do that this afternoon with no trouble. But even one a week will keep you ahead of where we're going through this. But I would encourage you to read 1 Peter and look at it and say, okay, are they telling me what, I mean, is it really what it says? There's a lot packed in here. And I'm going to work through the first nine verses, but I'm not going to cover everything that's in those first nine verses. I'm going to hit some of the highlights, and it would be good to, I mean, I'd encourage you to be looking through this on your own. Do your own reading of this. So let's look at the beginning of this letter. So this is Peter, who starts out, he says, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ. This is Peter who walked on water. This is Peter who denied Jesus three times. This is, upon this rock I will build my church, Peter. This is Peter. And actually, in my reading of this, nobody really disputes that. They say, no, this was really Peter. Now, when Jesus met him, he was a fisherman. He lived on the Sea of Galilee, and Jesus said, come, follow me, and I'll make you fishers of men. Peter, at that point, was probably not literate. Peter was a fisherman. Why would he need to read or write? All he did is his dad was a fisherman. He became a fisherman. That's what he did. He probably spoke Hebrew. Probably spoke some Greek as well. Because Greek was the trading language. And if you're selling fish to somebody who's Greek, you want to be able to speak their language. So he probably spoke some Greek, but probably not great Greek. It was probably rather rough. It was kind of a rough estimation of how the Greeks spoke. But he probably did that. So this is when Peter's young, he's illiterate, he's a fisherman, that's what he does. Jesus calls him and gets him to follow Jesus, and he spends 3 years with Jesus. Now this book, they think, is written probably about 30 years later, around 60 AD, something like that. And at this point, Peter may have become literate, may have learned how to read and write, may have learned how to read and write in Greek and in Hebrew. Maybe, maybe not. He does thank, in the verse we read in chapter 5 there, 5:12, he says, with the help of Silas, I've written this. So maybe Silas was his scribe who wrote it out for him. And people who read Greek, and I don't, tell me that this is really well-written Greek. Like it's the literate Greek, high literate. And this book is well-written. They actually say 2 Peter is written a little less finesse in Greek. And maybe Peter actually wrote that one, whereas Silas did the corrections on the first one. And we're not sure, but Peter wrote this. So this is that Peter. This is Peter who was the fisherman, became the fisher of men, became the rock on which the church was going to be built, and became the apostle of Jerusalem and then beyond that. And so he knows what happened. He was there through the whole life of Jesus, all through his ministry, through the death and resurrection. And now he's saying to the people that are out there, saying, here, I want to tell you. So who's he writing to? He starts out in verse 1. He said, I write to God's elect. Strangers in the world scattered throughout the provinces of Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, who have been chosen. And it goes on from there. So these are people. Now, where is this? Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia. Anybody know? I found a map. I don't know if you can see this very well. So on the right-hand side, there's Judea, Jerusalem, the Dead Sea, and the Sea of Galilee, or that little strip of water that runs down the just off the Mediterranean Sea. So that's Jerusalem, Judea down there. Cappadocia, if you look near the top, there's Cappadocia, Galatia, Bithynia, Pontus, Asia. It's that region up there. We now call that Turkey. Some of it's northern Iraq. It's where the Kurds live. But it's beyond Jerusalem and Judea. If you remember at the beginning of Acts, Jesus said, you're going to be witnesses for me in Jerusalem and in Judea and to the uttermost parts of the earth. Well, these people that he's writing to are from there. They're from way outside, probably some Jews and probably some not Jews, who are now becoming the church. It's a diverse group of people that Peter's writing to say, okay, here's the things you need to know. Here's some things that I want to tell you. So these are the people he's writing to, this group of people who aren't the followers of Jesus that Peter knew during the time of Jesus. They're not people who grew up in Jerusalem and, you know, always went to the temple. These are people from far away. And Peter's writing to them. But what does he call them? He said, okay, I want to write to you. He said, You are God's elect, strangers in the world, scattered in all these places, and you have been chosen. So these are God's, who are they? God's elect. There's an election going on in Canada now. Did you know that? The world's longest election. Well, Peter's using that term. There's an election. You are elected by God. You are strangers in the world. You are scattered. Throughout all those places, you are chosen. Are those positive terms or negative terms? Positive? Certainly the elect one is good, right? Chosen, that's pretty good. How about the strangers in the world? Lots of you have known lots of Christians, right? Do you know some that are kind of strange in the world? I remember being in high school and having Christian friends, but being quite embarrassed to be with them I could hang out with them at youth group, but in school, they were strange. And it was kind of difficult for me to be their friends because that kind of made you a bit of a social outcast because they were just kind of odd people. But they fit that, strangers in the world. And then people who are scattered around. He said, you're in all of these places. He said, I'm writing to you because you're part of the big church, but you're not a part of my team that started with me when Jesus was here. So they're positive and negative. You could take them all as positive. But these themes go on through the book. Later on, we're going to hear him talk about you being strangers and aliens on earth. That you have an inheritance somewhere else and not here on earth. And Peter wants to get that idea across right at the beginning. So we're God's elect. We're chosen. Chosen by who? Chosen, we go on in verse 2. Chosen by according to the foreknowledge of God the Father through the sanctifying work of the Spirit for obedience to Jesus Christ and sprinkling by his blood. So we've been chosen by God. Take a look at that verse up there. Who's in that verse? Who does he refer to? God the Father, the Spirit, and Jesus Christ. Pulls all three of those into that verse kind of handily, doesn't he? A little bit of an idea of the Trinity. Hadn't been defined as the Trinity at that point, but the idea that the three parts of the Godhead are all there, and Peter says, you know, those are all important. They all play a role. God the Father chose us through his foreknowledge. The Spirit sanctifies us. Sanctify means to set apart. That's a bit of that being strangers in the world. You're set apart and you're a little bit different than everybody else. And then being obedient to Christ and sprinkled by his blood. We're going to come back a little bit to later to talking about Jesus and the role that he plays. But here's God the Father who chose us according to his foreknowledge. Did you choose to become a Christian? Most of us grew up in a church, in an evangelical, where at some point you made a decision, right? You prayed a prayer, you went forward at a service, somewhere you made that decision. Here Peter says, yeah, but you're chosen by God by his foreknowledge. Well, I'm not going to get into a huge theological debate here, because there have been centuries of debate about this. But there is a role that God plays, and the foreknowledge, actually somebody explained it to me, it's like God has watched the end of our movie, and he knows what's going to happen. So he has foreknowledge of that. Have you ever watched a movie a second time? And you know what's coming? Can you change it? Can you say, no, no, don't do that? It's too late. You can't change it, can you? But you've watched it. You've seen it to the end, and you know what's going to happen. So you've got foreknowledge when the second time you watch it. And it's like God has done that with us. He knows where we're going, and he knows the choices we're going to make. But he's got foreknowledge, but he also chose us. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that, but I'm not going to sort it out this morning. But there is a role that God plays, and there's a role that we play. And God's given us free will, and we make our own decisions. But God knows who we are, knows the ones who are going to follow him. And the Spirit plays a key role in setting us apart and pulling us toward obedience, and Jesus plays the role of saving us, of the, sprinkling us with his blood, of bringing us to him. But this is a big deal. that God chose us. I want you to think about that. And that's kind of the key point I want to make today. God chose us. He chose you. So in an election, God's elect, I mean, we pick somebody to be, we pick people to be our government, right? We get to vote. October 19th, we get to vote for your MP. And we weigh the merits and we think about who, what the parties are and what they stand for. We look at the individuals. We look at who would become prime minister if we voted for this person. We weigh a bunch of things. We think about, okay, who's got the best leadership qualities? Who has the best economic action plan? Who has the nicest hair? And then eventually we vote and we pick. We elect somebody. And whether it's our candidate or the prime minister or the party, however we decide to weigh, although some merit, we weigh and we make a decision on who we're going to vote for. And we pick someone. And Peter says that we are like that. That God has looked at us and has elected us. He has chosen us. He's chosen you. He's picked you out of the crowd and said, you know what? I want you. That's a big deal, I think. God knows me and picked me. He knows my name. He knows who I am. And he said, yeah, I want you on my team. I want to elect you. So here we are, strangers in the world, scattered around, but chosen by God and elected by him. And then Peter moves on and he says, okay, and then he has a greeting. Sort of sets up the next part. He says, grace and peace be yours in abundance. There's lots in that, grace and peace. He said, that's what we're offering you. Praise be to God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Which is kind of the launch into the next section. But a bit of, call this inspirational or emotional a little bit. You know, this is grace and peace to you. Praise be to God. This is not just theology here. He's trying to pull in their emotions a little bit. And then he gets into the body of the letter, and he starts talking about God's mercy. Now, this is, when I started working through this, these are long and complicated sentences when you start reading them. And so I said, okay, the best way to do this is my favorite way of attacking the Bible. It's what we call inductive Bible study, and I ask three questions. And the questions are, what does it say? So we're going to try and unwind some of these sentences and pull them apart so we can figure out exactly what he's saying. And then the second question, Jolene, is what? What does it mean? So we're going to look at that. And then the third one is, so what? How does it apply to me? So we're going to try and work through that, through this passage this morning. And I've already started with the what does it say part. But this is what does it say. So verses 3 to 5. In his great mercy, he has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead and into an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade. This inheritance is kept in heaven for you who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming of the salvation that is ready to be revealed in the last time. Have you counted how many phrases are in there? There's a whole bunch. It's actually two sentences. But into this, into that, by this, by that, there's a bunch in there. But I'm going to pull out a few thoughts on there. One about mercy, one about new birth, one about living hope, and one about an inheritance. So this is God's mercy. So God, this goes back to the chosen part. When God chose us, he didn't choose us because we are the best leaders or the best economic managers or we have the nicest hair. He chose us because of his mercy. It's his mercy. Praise. So Peter started this section with, praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In his great mercy, he has given us new birth. It's through his mercy. It's up to him to choose, and we're the beneficiaries of that selection in his mercy. Now, then he talks about a birth and a hope through the resurrection. So through his mercy, he's given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. Earlier, he talked about the sprinkling of blood from Jesus. Now he's talking about the resurrection of Jesus. So we've got the death and the resurrection, and that gives us a new hope, a living hope, a new birth. But he says that birth gives us also an inheritance. A special inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade. I don't know how many of you have ever received an inheritance. Money that somebody gave you, maybe a house or something like that, maybe just, you know, the family dishes that, you know, grandma used to have that you've inherited, that you have to take care of because they could spoil or fade. This morning, actually, when I was having my coffee, I broke a cup. It wasn't an inheritance at all. I just got it free somewhere, and it was like, okay, well, too bad, and broke. But Peter said the kind of inheritance we get from Jesus isn't one that's going to break. It's not going to fade. It's not going to spoil. In fact, it's an inheritance that's kept in heaven for you. So there, you want an ironclad guarantee? You want an extended warranty? There's one that we have that on. This inheritance we have is an inheritance that's not going to fade away. It's not going to spoil. In fact, it's not left somewhere that it will spoil. It's saved in heaven for us. Saved in heaven for you who through faith are shielded by God's power into the coming of the salvation that is ready to be revealed in the last time. Okay, verse 5, who's the who that he's talking to? Us. So we have this inheritance that's saved for us, but we also have a faith that's shielded by God's power. So not only is the inheritance protected by an extended warranty that's never going to have any problems with, so we are protected who have faith. What's it say? Our faith is shielded by God's power until the coming of salvation that's ready to be revealed. So our faith gives us a force field of God's power around us, protects us from the things that are going to come at us. So we have an inheritance that's guaranteed, but we also have a faith that protects us, that's going to protect us as we live through this world. Because what happens in this world? Peter says, well, you're going to face trials, and you need to have that faith that protects us when trials come along. Because not always does it feel like we are elected, we are selected, we are protected. But Peter says, no, it's true. You are. Because he said, in all this you should greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials. I like how he puts this. And now for a little while you may have to suffer a little bit. These people, the temple in Jerusalem was torn down and burned in 72 AD. This is about 60 AD. There's a growing persecution against the Jews. There's a growing persecution against Christians. Christians are killed at this time. This is kind of as the Romans were starting to get geared up on the whole idea of the throwing the Christians to the lions and things like that. And Peter goes, yeah. He said, you know, for a little while, there might be a few problems here and there. I mean, this is Peter who actually got crucified upside down, because they were going to crucify him and say, oh, yeah, you're a follower of Jesus. We're going to crucify you just like Jesus. And he finally said, no, don't, please. He said, if you're going to crucify me, do me upside down so I'm not like Jesus. I don't want to go that way. I'm not Jesus. But, I mean, Peter knew what it was like, and he knew that this was coming. And he says, yeah, for a little while, things might be a little bit negative to us. So I would say it's a little bit of an understatement. But he says, so there you are. For a little while, you may have had to suffer grief and all kinds of trials. These come so that what? So that the proven genuineness of your faith, which is worth more than gold and which perishes even though refined by fire, may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus is revealed. So he says there's a couple of reasons that we hang on to our faith during trials, or that we have trials. One is to prove the genuineness of our faith. We said we have faith that gives us this protection from God, but we go through trials to prove that our faith is genuine, which is, as he says, greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire. So now he's made two references to inheritances that spoil or fade, and gold that will eventually fade even if it is refined by fire. So he says, but one point is that it'll be proven by your faith, and the other is that it may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus comes again. So there's a long-term
view as well as a short-term view. The short-term is that our faith will be proven genuine. And long-term is that eventually we're going to get praise, honor, and glory from that. But then he makes one more point about faith. So this idea about faith keeps coming back. He says in verses 8 and 9, though you haven't seen him, you love him. So these are people who are living far away from Jerusalem in the area that's now Turkey. So they didn't know Jesus. They didn't live through his ministry. They didn't see it happen. They are a second generation Christian. So they didn't see him, but they still love him. They believe in him. They're filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy, for you're receiving the end result of your faith, which is the salvation of your souls. Okay, three little phrases I want to pull out there. So they haven't seen him, but yet they love him. They haven't seen him, but yet they believe in him. And that's going to fill them with inexpressible and glorious joy. So these people, they're like us. We haven't seen Jesus. We didn't live through it. We didn't see the miracles. We didn't get to eat the bread from when he fed the 5,000. We didn't do any of that stuff. But even though we don't see him, we believe in him. Or we love him. That's kind of the definition of faith, isn't it? That there's something out there that you don't see, but you still have faith in it. You still believe in it. And this belief in him, this love of him, fills us with inexpressible and glorious joy. Because, again, he's looking far down the road, because you are receiving the end result of your faith, which is the salvation of your souls. So there's a long-term goal here in your faith. That was a run through a whole bunch of stuff in there. I kind of tried to unwind a little bit of it, but there's lots more in there. So what is he? So let's take a look. So I've gone through the first 9 verses. That's as far as I'm going to go today. So what did we say there? What does it say? So this is a letter that's written to God's elect, to God's chosen. God's given us a living hope into a new birth, into an inheritance. So we have an inheritance. Now we're going to have trials while we're here on earth, but they're there to prove the genuineness of our faith, and they will eventually result in praise. And although we haven't seen Jesus, we believe in him, we love him, and we're filled with an inexpressible joy. So that's what it says. So what does it mean? What can we pull out from that? Well, first of all, that part about we are God's elect, that's a big one. Here we are, strangers in the world, scattered around. And we have been chosen by God. Actually, I'm jumping ahead of myself. So here we are. So this is Peter, who was writing to some people who were kind of on the edge of the world from where Peter was. They were way over there in Turkey. I don't know if Peter had any idea how many generations this would go on and on and on, and but this book would continue to be relevant. To people who didn't live through what he lived through, didn't see Jesus, all they had were what was written down. And he said, okay, but I want you to understand that even though you didn't live through it, you are still part of God's chosen. You are God's elect. God's elect have an inheritance. An inheritance that isn't going to spoil or fade. It's kept for us in heaven. So by being God's elect, there's benefits on earth, but there's also benefits in the future. But although we're chosen, it's up to us to exercise our faith. We have a role to play. We must test it out. We must claim this protection that God says he will provide to come through our faith. Now, it's a faith that's worth more than riches. It's a faith that's going to be proven through trials. And it's a faith that has the goal at the end of salvation. So being God's elect doesn't mean we can sit back and relax. We can gloat over, oh, look at us, we're picked. We're God's elect. We don't have to worry about anybody else. We made it. No, rather it gives us a chance to exercise our faith. And so here we got God's power on one side and our faith on the other side. And somehow those two work together. God picks us, but we pick God, and somehow those two work together. He gives us a new birth and an inheritance. A new birth that applies now and an inheritance that's for the future. And our faith is required to make that a reality. Our faith will bring us the protection through the trials that we're going to face. So what? So we're chosen. So what? I don't know if any of you have run for office. Anybody here been an MP or an MLA or an MPP? I had to think back. In grade four, I did. I can't remember now at the end if I was the president or the secretary of the Red Cross Society of my grade four classroom, but something. I got elected. And I remember that feeling of, oh, look at that, I got picked. Everybody in my class voted for me, or enough people voted for me, and I got picked. And that was great. And I feel, oh. But then you realize, oh, but that means now I have to do something. And I remember, and I can remember this in grade four in elementary school in central Alberta. We, whatever it was once a month or something, our classroom, we had the regular meeting of the Red Cross Society. We actually raised money and helped out families that had a house burned down. I remember that. We did some other things. But the teacher was smart. She had us, but we ran it like whatever they're called, the Robert's Rules of Order. Like, we had a president who spoke. We had motions from the floor. We seconded them. We voted on them. We discussed them. We had somebody took minutes, all of those things. But I remember being really nervous that day because here I am standing up in front of my class to run this process. I had responsibility on my shoulders because I was elected. But I was thinking, you know, if you're an MP getting elected or an MPP or you're elected in city council or something like that, you must feel the same way. Like that next morning after the election, you think, man, I did all this work. Oh, I got selected. More people voted for me than all those other people with bad hair. They picked me. But you can't stop saying, oh, look at that. Lucky me. Because they picked you for a purpose. There's a reason you got picked. And then it's like, okay, now get down to work. Because we want you to fix our roads and fix the potholes. And we want you to give us better health care. There's all these things that we want from you because we elected you. And to some extent, I think it's the same thing for us as Christians. We are God's elect. We are chosen. And there's a privilege to that. But we're chosen. And there's a responsibility to that. We can't just say, oh yeah, we got picked. I prayed that prayer and now I'm in. That's it. That's done. I don't have to worry about it again. It's not quite how it works, is it? So we're chosen, but we have responsibilities. So we should recognize, and there's nothing wrong with recognizing the privileged position that we're in. We should celebrate that. We should sing about that. We should thank God for that. We should praise Him for that. We should enjoy that. That God knows us, and He still picks us. That's the amazing thing. That was the song that Julian had us sing earlier. You know, is your grace run out if I let you down? Am I still your child if I lie to you? And, you know, I let God down. I lied to Him. And you know what? He still has picked me. And He's picked you, Marcella. He knows your name. He has picked you. Val, He has picked you. He knows you. He's picked Betty back there. He's picked Grant. And He's picked Ben. He knows you, and He picked you. And you know what? When you fail Him, He still says, that's okay. I still pick you. I still want you. You are my elect. You have the privileged place of being here. I said you have some responsibilities too, but you have the privileged place of being here. You are part of my elect. So we have this privileged place, but we also have some responsibility. Responsibility to exercise our faith. A responsibility to love Him. This is what He said in verses 8 and 9. These people hadn't seen Jesus, but they love Him. They believe in Him. And they're filled with joy. That's kind of how our faith should show itself out, shouldn't it? It should show us in the fact that we love Jesus, we believe in Him, And we've got something inside of us that makes us a bit stranger in the world. We've got this joy that's in there that doesn't quite make sense in a very common human sense. So then the so what question is, if you had a reference check done from people who know you, went and asked people who are your family, your friends, people you work with, would they say those things? Oh, yeah, I know him. You know what? He believes in God. He loves him. And he's got this joy inside. I thought about that myself. I thought, nah. I'm not sure that that would come across if you went and talked to the people that work with me. Maybe parts of that. They might go, yeah, no, I know he goes to church. And a few people know that I preach once in a while, and that's like, well, he's a weird guy. You're really serious about this church thing. It's one thing to go to church. That's okay. I mean, lots of people do that. But would they, the rest of it, would that show up? But that's Peter saying, you know, you're picked, which is a privileged position, but you've got some responsibility. And that should show out in your love for Jesus, your faith in him, and how we react to the world, even as we face trials. There's a joy, an inexpressible joy that's in there. Now, as we go through the rest of the book, that's going to play out more. You're going to see about how what that means. How do we live then? And he talks about husbands and wives. How do we live in our families? He talks about submission to authorities. How do we live in relation to the world out there? He talks about how we should behave with our bosses, how we should behave in the church. So there's going to be more of this about, okay, what does this mean? How does this look? How does this faith play out in real life? But he starts off the book by saying, okay, you have to understand the position you are in, the privileged position you have, but that privilege comes with some responsibility. You've been elected, but now to do something. And so Peter is getting us started on this journey of, okay, so what does this mean? Where does it take us? How do we live from here? Understanding that God chose us through our faith. Our faith plays a key role. Those two interact a lot. And yet, but that puts us in a very special, privileged, but also special responsibility kind of position. To love him, to believe in him, and to be filled with the joy that shows itself out in how we live.